You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another awesome episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul, and today we have the pleasure and honor of welcoming the FAA. Today, straight from Minneapolis, Minnesota, Mr. Kevin Morris, who's the Director of Operations for the FAST team, but also a FISDO inspector. Kevin, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me on, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's actually a pleasure for you to be here, my friend. I really can't say thank you enough. So many questions swirling in the drone community, not only the Drone You private group, but the drone community as a whole. I know you're actually an active member in many of the Facebook groups now, and I just have to say that I applaud you for that. I applaud you. What you're doing in the Facebook community is truly amazing. You're putting yourself out there. You're answering questions. And so many people, you know, want to know, are you kind of an advocate within the FAA for drone operators?
So it's interesting. Advocate, I'm not sure I'd use that word to describe me, although I'm very supportive of Part 107 and unmanned aircraft system operations moving forward. I don't think anybody should have the misunderstanding that drones are something that are going to go away. They're really the future right now of aviation as we look at it. So one of my jobs as a FAST team program manager is to do education and outreach. I've done that through in-person seminars, jumped on this podcast with you or Facebook groups like you mentioned. But one of the key things, and I always bring this up, is that the FAA finally did their part. We got Part 107 released. It gives you the framework to go ahead and start operating commercially in the United States. Now the responsibility is upon the drone community. How this works, whether we need more regulations or whether we loosen some of the regulations, is really on the drone community's shoulders. And so for me, the key to that is education. So I love going out and speaking. So I guess maybe in that manner, I'm certainly an advocate for the unmanned aircraft community, but it's because of the education piece I want to get out there. If everybody does a good job and we get the rules out there and you guys follow the rules and we operate and people can run successful businesses, Part 107 will only get better. And unfortunately, it would probably go the other way if we have a lot of rogue operators and we end up having a lot of incidents with UAS.
Definitely going to be an issue. We've got a lot to go over today because there is a lot of confusion kind of around 107. And I think that a lot of people expected that 107 would come out and kind of, you know, squash the confusion. But it seems that even in some of the terminology that we see, even on the FAA website, that it can sometimes confuse people. So you've said, hey, I'm going to come on the show and I am going to squash the confusion. And one of those things that we're talking about, a term that's used interchangeably, the COA versus the cow, as I like to say it. Now, don't have a cow just yet. I want to talk about those nighttime waivers and those airspace waivers, or excuse me, authorizations. Can you help us understand what is the difference between an authorization and a waiver? Rob, I know you've been traveling the world and flying your drone in places that most people haven't experienced.
Like Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Well, no matter where you're traveling to, no matter where you're capturing footage, chances are someone else probably wants some of that footage.
Absolutely. If you're a pilot, and a lot of you are obviously, you've probably got literally tens if not hundreds of gigs of footage out there that you don't know what to do with. It's just sitting there.
And you're probably not like Rob, because the only drone Rob actually uses to capture footage is the Sima. So if you have nice 4K quality stabilized footage and you'd like to sell some of it, you've got to check out videoblocks.com. But by the way, Rob, if you create and produce videos, which I know you do, and you need some B-roll, some segue, some transitions, maybe some After Effects backgrounds, guess what? VideoBlocks has all of that, over 115,000 clips for one annual rate. Now, I know that sounds crazy. Normally, you spend like $20-$50 per, you know, video.
Absolutely.
Not with VideoBlocks. It's one low fee. Now, if you're a listener of Ask Drone You and you go to videoblocks.com/drone, you actually get $50 off an annual subscription, or 33%. I'm not sure which seems more significant to you, Rob.
Well, we'll let the listeners decide on which is more significant to them, but it is only $99 a year. That's pretty incredible.
For $99, 115,000 HD clips to augment your aerial video, and you can also sell your aerial video on the side. You're not going to want to miss this. So go to videoblocks.com/drone today.
There's a few different definitions that are out there floating around, and a lot of people use them interchangeably. One of the first ones I want to get clear is just the exemption. We have waivers and authorizations on our web portal right now, which most Part 107 operators are familiar with, but we also have exemptions. So an exemption is different than a waiver, and a waiver is different than an ATC authorization, and quite frankly, an ATC authorization is different than a COA. So we have all these terms that are being tossed around out there, and there are folks on our side that use them a little bit interchangeably. Unfortunately, our website design through the waiver authorization portal sort of is the same form, one big form for really two very different requests, one waiver, one authorization. So I wanted to clear that up a little bit. Under Part 107, the FAA has come forward and given a list of rules which are subject to waiver. I don't recall the specific Part 107 rule, but it's like 107.200, something of that nature. At any rate, we list 9 or 10, I think, different parts of 107 that can be waived. And you touched on one of them, which is daylight operations. If you want to operate your drone at night, you're going to need a waiver from the daylight operation rule. So I'll explain waiver first. A waiver is a request from a user to not comply with a particular rule which the FAA has identified may be subject to waiver. Now, when you go to request a waiver, the only method we have available right now is our online portal. It's the same portal that people are going to use for their authorization requests. So there are instructions on how to fill out that request form, and there's also something called performance-based standards, which address every single one of those rules which the FAA has said is open to waiver and how somebody might submit a request for that. So, for example, if you go in there and you look at the performance-based standard document, it's a PDF document on that page, it will tell you the operator needs to address these issues when they submit their waiver request. On that same form, also is an authorization request. An authorization request is not a waiver. When somebody wants to operate in Class Echo to the surface or Class Delta or in the future Charlie and Bravo airspace, you are not most likely going to request a waiver for that. You're going to request an authorization. This really is designed to be no different than a manned aircraft pilot radioing a tower requesting permission to enter the airspace. So what's confusing for a lot of people is it's the one form, but it's two separate requests in there. You have the waiver and the authorization. Now, you can request an airspace waiver. And what that means is you are requesting relief from the rule that requires you to notify ATC that you're going to be operating in their airspace. As a rule of thumb, you probably won't get that waiver. I just off the top of my head, I can't think of too many very valid reasons why you should be able to fly in, let's say, Class Delta airspace and not ever let air traffic know you're there. So when people want ATC authorization, they want it through the same portal, but it's an authorization. Finally, COA, or the Certificate of Authorization, is a document issued by air traffic control primarily for public use operations. In the UAS community, COAs were issued for both public use and 333 exemption holders at the time. If you remember, 333 exemptions came out, and with that, they got that blanket COA, or you could request a specific COA to operate outside of that. I think they limited to 200 feet or something like that initially. That's not what you're requesting when you submit your ATC authorization request. So the waiver, which I just explained, the authorization, which is a request for ATC to operate in their airspace, the COA, which is something that used primarily for public use and 333 exemption holders, are all different. And on top of all that is exemption. So what is an exemption? That is a request or petition to the FAA to not comply with the rule that the FAA has not deemed waivable. So if you look at Part 107, you find that Reg 107.200 something, whatever it might be, and you see all those rules. If you want to, for example, get relief from having a remote pilot in command, having a remote pilot in command is not a waiverable rule under Part 107. You would need to file for an exemption. Exemptions are all handled through headquarters, Washington, D.C. folks. They're much more complicated than waivers. So I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of confusion between exemption, waiver, authorization, and co-op.
There definitely is. And I know a lot of people are, you know, trying to get blanket authorizations, you know, as you have mentioned. And the other day you had put out this little nice handy dandy form, which says, if you are looking to fly and get ATC authorization in, say, Delta or Echo airspace, that you have these rule of thumbs, or the good rule of thumb to follow. Do you want to go over these with me really quick? I know you may not have it in front of you, but you were talking about, you know, in 0 to 2 miles, currently not granting any SUAS authorizations, correct?
Yeah, and so just to expand on that a little bit, one of the biggest frustrations that I hear from the UAS community across the board, probably the number one frustration people have, is the ATC authorization process. Nobody likes it. It takes too long. There's no way you know what you're doing 90 days in advance. So weekly I get on internal briefings, and one of our internal briefings had an air traffic individual who was involved in the process of, I don't know if he was directly approving or denying the ATC request, but certainly was involved in the process of how the system is designed. And one of the things he said is, we have this airspace grid, right? And every airport has this airspace grid, and the grid is defined out, and it has different altitudes and different locations. But he said, since we don't have any of those published, a good rule of thumb is, and that's when I took down those notes. So right now, the rule of thumb is, if you're requesting an ATC authorization in class Echo to the Surface or class Delta from 0 to 2 miles, it will most likely be denied at this time.
Gotcha. But 2 to 3 miles on average, operations could be granted, say, up to about 100 feet?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you about time frame, because I've been hearing a lot of issues as well concerning time frame. I'm not trying to jump around, but you said there are concerns in the community. I'm aware of those as well. And someone said, do we really have to put a authorization request in 90 days prior to the operation itself?
Well, let me give you the good government answer here on this one. I'm sure it won't be popular, but listen, I'll try to explain it the best I can too, so everybody can and start screaming at their screens or their iPhones when they start hearing this podcast at this point. We have to have some sort of guidance for us when we process waivers or authorizations to say that we will get it done no matter what within this time frame. Waivers have always been 90 days. And so what happened in the manned aircraft world worked well for a long, long time. And now we're switching into the immediacy of UAS operations. UAS operations, while certainly are aircraft operated by pilots in the National Airspace System, they're not similar to manned aircraft in terms of missions nor flight time. There's some serious differences. So, yes, the only authorized way for you to receive an ATC authorization for Class Delta or Echo to the Surface at this time, keep in mind Charlie and Bravo Airspace are not up and running yet for authorizations, is to submit your request through the online portal. And we request that you do that with at least 90 days lead time to give us to go through that. So here's where I'm sure everybody's shaking their head, shaking their fist, yelling at their screen. Let me just say this. We realize that's not working as we hoped it would. But in talking with the air traffic individual on the last briefing, I brought this up. I specifically brought up the point of these 90-day lead times. You know, they're not working out. They're not practical for UAS. So here's the answer. Love it or hate it, but this is where we're at right now. The system's not working as well as we wanted it to. The goal has always been for ATC authorizations to be as near real time as we could possibly get, meaning you submit your request, and within minutes, you get a response back authorizing or denying or requesting further information for your request. Obviously, we are nowhere near that right now.
Let me stop you and let me ask you a question really quick. Do you think that the lead time issue and the current implementation time issue is because DC or headquarters has taken over these airspace authorization requests, whereas normally they would be going through your local ATC officer?
I think you could make arguments on both sides, and here's how I'd present that. For one particular tower, they might get one Part 107 authorization request every couple weeks, maybe. Not such a big deal. You have other air traffic facilities that would probably get 15 a day. The air traffic facilities at those airports aren't designed to handle those types of requests. Obviously, they cater to manned aircraft first because they're flying in the sky, and that, you know, they got to get them on the ground, or they got to keep the manned aircraft people separated, because when two manned aircraft bump into each other, it's considerably worse than two unmanned aircraft bumping into each other in terms of potential lives lost. So you have a risk, you have a priority as an air traffic group and organization. So they're designed, built, and procedures driven to handle real-time type requests that way. U.S. presents a different type of request. In generally speaking, as you know, Paul, most U.S. requests are probably not going to be anywhere near interfering with manned aircraft. But on that one side of the coin, if you've got a facility that was getting 15 to 20 requests a day by people calling in on the telephone or trying to radio in with a handheld mic, that would really have a negative impact on safety. You know, their job is to keep airplanes apart.
Well, it would probably also have a negative impact if you have people talking on the radio who haven't really been well-versed in how to communicate with a tower, because the worst thing that could happen is you've got, you know, a radio operator saying, you know, trying to explain to someone over the radio how to operate the radio, and that could be significantly troublesome. So, all right, the light at the end of the tunnel here. You guys are trying to make this an instantaneous process. You're trying to make it so that I can hop on my iPhone. I can say, instead of calling you up, Kevin, and say, hey, Kevin, I need some airspace authorization right now, which I doubt you'd answer the phone. But you're trying to make it so that in time, and I don't know when that time is, but in time, we'll be able to go on our phone. We'll be able to say where we want to fly and get permission to fly almost instantaneously. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's always been the goal. And that, honestly, that has to be the goal that we reach. The one thing we're working on now is the update I got. We're reaching out to contractors and vendors to get bids on developing an app for your mobile device or your tablet, so that you can open up the app. It'll be an automated process. So the grid maps will be developed. You'll be put into a system coordinated against GPS reference points, where you open up your app, you're standing the location you want to operate in. Let's say it's 3.7 miles away from the airport center of a Class D airport, and you need to go up to 100 feet or 200 feet. You put that information into the app. It goes to the server, compares it against that grid map, and kicks you back, for lack of a better description, a green light. You're good to go, and it gives you a time frame for the next 30 minutes or something of that nature. Or it may give you a red light. Nope, they have arrival quarter or approaching aircraft. You can't go in that particular spot in that particular time, or may request more information. So we're aware of the issue. Believe me, I hear and I feel for everyone out there in the U.S. community right now trying to do this the right way. I appreciate it. I can't thank you guys enough for using the portal, for trying to do this the right way. We're still playing catch up in some areas, this being one of them. And unfortunately, this gives people the most heartburn. But definitely our goal, and it, again, we have to reach this goal, is to make it as near instantaneous as we can.
Well, we definitely appreciate that. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are frustrated. But one thing that I would love to see the FAA do, and I know if you had a magic wand, you would probably make this happen. I would love to see the FAA work more closely with just general UAV operators, instead of these, you know, big lobbying groups that really represent different intentions than just regular UAS operations. And I'm saying this because I'm sure some of your colleagues are going to end up watching this. So, dear FAA colleagues, I would really love to see a nice little group of UAS operators, small-time guys, helping provide feedback, because I think that I think that could be really beneficial to have a nice open line of communication from our operators to you guys. All right, so as far as everything that you've said and getting authorizations, it's going to be almost difficult to impossible to get really a blanket authorization. I know you had mentioned that, but I just want to make this really clear for everyone. So pretty much, if we want to try and get a blanket authorization, say 2 to 5 miles out, it's not going to happen, correct?
Yeah, it's really tough. There's two types of blanket authorizations that we see come in. The first one is they want an authorization for most of a chunk of controlled airspace. So I want to operate my UAS from 2 to 4 miles out, anywhere around the airport, up to 400 feet. Probably will not get that approved as a blanket authorization. The other ones we'll see come in will be, they'll put a reference point, but then they'll draw a 50-mile radius encompassing 3 different class deltas and 8 different echoes to the surface and say, here's my point, here's my radius, I want to go up to 400 feet in all these areas. That's the other type of authorization that's not going to be approved. But keep in mind, when you're submitting your authorization request, air traffic wants to handle you as close as they can to manned aircraft, meaning they want to know where you are, how high you are, how long you're going to be there, and when you're going to be on the ground. And so if you get too broad of a request, it's too, like we use a blanket, too much of a blanket area, it makes them awfully difficult for them to know exactly when you are flying and where you are flying at and how high you are when they've got traffic, manned aircraft traffic coming in and out.
Gotcha. All right, let's move on. So, you know, one of the questions that's been brought up is, we talked about the difference between COAs and COWs and ATC authorizations. And normally, if I'm sitting in my Cessna or my powered parachute, which we had talked about yesterday, and I'm at, you know, P-48 down in Peoria, Arizona, and I say, hey, you know, this is a November 703 Delta Uniform requesting permission to take off, you know, that ATC comes back and says, you know, permission to taxi, you know, permission to take off, blah, blah, blah. That's my ATC authorization right there to fly in that airspace, which normally I'm heading out of the airspace, but you kind of get the example I'm giving. So as far as a UAS operator is concerned, how does the FAA feel about local ATC authority giving official or unofficial permission for a UAS operator to operate in that immediate airspace?
Well, let me jump back to my government answer. Sorry to do this twice on one podcast. The only recognized method to request ATC authorization is our online portal, which is the combined waiver and authorization portal that you're going to find on FAA.gov.
But just to clarify, that's a little bit different than the manned aviation route that would. So if we were a plane, for example, that portal is different than how a normal aviation pilot would go about doing his job, correct?
That's correct. That portal is designed specifically for Part 107 UAS operators only.
So let me ask the question a little bit better. If someone wanted to circumvent the online COA process, let's say President Obama calls me and says, Paul, I really want you to fly, you know, over here. That's probably a better Bill Clinton impression than
Obama. Yeah, it sounded like me. That's yeah. Okay.
Hey, I get them confused all the time. but let's say that they want me to fly something, and it's in a few days, and it's in Delta airspace, and I've worked together closely with that particular air traffic controller for years, thanks to the 333 exemption process. But that being said, what if you were to circumvent the online COA process? I mean, is it technically illegal, is I guess the question I'm asking.
Sure. Well, I guess in your example, if the president is requesting you to operate a UAS, you're probably going to be able to do that regardless of any sort of regulation out there. But no, to really get to your question, there is no rule under Part 107 that I would say you can't try that. But here's the problem. Air traffic has been instructed through their own guidance and their own procedures not to approve it. The official FAA answer is we do not want Part 107 operators calling the tower directly, via the phone or via a two-way handheld radio. If you look at the rule in Part 107, it talks about receiving authorization from ATC. It doesn't specify how. So
that's where I was going.
The rule itself wouldn't necessarily prevent you from picking up the phone, calling your local tower, saying, you know, hey, Diane, I'd like to operate in class Delta airspace. We have guidance. We have procedures on the air traffic FAA side, which instructs controllers to redirect you to the authorization portal. So if you were to do that, and let's say try to circumvent the process, and you pick up the phone and you call the tower, and that particular tower operator was feeling a little bit savvy that day and decided that they were going to say, you know what, Paul, I don't care. Go ahead. It doesn't matter to me. Go fly your UAS in my Delta airspace. I don't really care.
Which has happened. As you know, you've heard it from other stories. It's happened.
Mm-hmm. Which has definitely happened. Now, the chance of the flight standards district office inspector finding out about that, running out there and dealing with it is probably pretty low. But if something were to happen, let's say you had a lost link procedure, or you had a flyaway with your small unmanned aircraft, and it hit something else, it somehow made the news, it somehow got the attention. One of the things the FAA does, in addition to obviously investigating the event itself with the operator, would be to take a look at the air traffic. It's in their airspace, their responsibility. And if they find that there's a particular air traffic controller that has stepped outside the bounds of guidance, has not followed direct procedure, they really put themselves out there kind of on their own pedestal all by themselves because they're not following our guidance. And that's not unique to air traffic control. The same with FAA inspectors doing a ramp check. If we start going well outside of our guidance on a ramp check, we really kind of stick our own necks out there. So while there's nothing to prevent you from trying to circumvent the rules, as a professional, I request that you do not do that. And air traffic has been instructed to redirect you to the portal, so you should not be getting authorizations from them for trying to circumvent that process.
Totally understood. I will say I it gives me hope. And it makes me happy that some ATC guys have said, you know, look, we're told to send you to the process, but, you know, we realize that, you know, if Sony Pictures calls you and they want you to shoot in 2 weeks, that the whole 90-day thing isn't going to work. And we don't really want to inhibit commerce, especially for American pilots. So I will say I know officially that that's not, you know, the right thing to do. And I understand officially that the ATC operator, his feet can be held to the fire if something, you know, bad happens. But I will say between you and I, it gives me hope that even you, Kevin, realize that this process isn't working and you're taking steps to make it better every day. So I just want to say thank you for that. And thank you to the ATC ops who, you know, it's from what I've heard, Kevin, and I've had this situation myself. I'm not going to say which airport, but in one of the coastal areas of the eastern United States, I had an ATC operator say, you know, Paul, if this operation was a risk to safety, my airport or anyone on my radar screen, I would tell you right now not to fly. But I can't tell you yes, but I'm not going to tell you no. So, and that's why I wanted to ask you that question. It's like, okay, well, where is this legal line? Because for me, that's so important because I never want to get in trouble with a guy like you or another FISDO inspector. There's a couple who have my name probably on speed dial right now, but I never want to upset them. I just wanted to ask you that question. Now let's move on. Another problem with the current airspace authorizations is the fact that a lot of the guys who, let's just say, without generalizing, they're unhappy for whatever reason. They're unhappy and they decide to operate illegally, whether they say screw the whole 107 process or screw the whole ATC thing. A lot of people are wondering what's being done about that because the perception in our Drone U community, and I think the perception in some of the communities you're a part of online, is that these illegal operations are only growing where we thought after 107 they would rather retract. So what is being done, Kevin, and what is the best route if someone sees an illegal operator, you know, what's the best thing to do?
Another good question. When we look at illegal UAS operations, we look at it in terms of, like the air traffic controller might have told you, we look at it in terms of risk to the national airspace system. Then we also need to look at it in terms of personnel resources. How much people do we have to go out there? So the odds of us happening to be in the field and see a UAS operation and then go up and find out that it's an illegal operation, conduct an enforcement investigation, process it, and prosecute it in court is probably slim for us going out there to catch it. We just don't have the manpower to be standing out there. And unlike manned aircraft, UAS flight times are 15 minutes on average, maybe, before you've got to start coming back down. So it's a short duration of legal activity. Where we get a lot of complaints are the continued short durations of illegal activity. Now, it's not just one time. It's this individual doing it again and again and again and again. And hey, look, they even have a website and they're advertising prices and they've uploaded their videos. And so they're running an entire business outside of 107. We want to know about those guys. Contrary to maybe some rumors that are out there or maybe what you feel or believe, we do want to know. Illegal UAS operations need to be investigated and they need to be dealt with. We don't look at it in terms of because it's going to save your business or it'll get rid of your competition that's out there doing it for half the cost because they don't carry insurance, for example. We look in terms of endangering the NAS. You know what it took to get a remote pilot certificate. You know the studying it took. You probably cursed a few times at the FAA. Why do I need to know that? And you went in and you took that written exam. And you're like, this is the most ridiculous question ever. It doesn't even make sense for UAS. There's a reason every question's in there.
I felt me-tarded. Okay, that's all I have to say.
So those folks going out there who are not remote pilot certified, who are not operating a registered UAS, are not safe. And they're endangering the NAS. And we need to know about it. So what do you do? Every state has a flight standards district office. And my recommendation would be to gather the evidence, gather the information, and supply that to the office. I will say, and I can only legitimately speak for the Minneapolis FISDO, but I believe every other FISDO is doing the same. We investigate every report we get. So every time we get a report of an illegal UAS activity, it doesn't go into some circular file. It doesn't go into the junk mail on our email servers. We have to investigate it. Now, not every one is going to be a huge multi-million dollar fine, or we're not, you know, we don't kick doors in and confiscate drones. But we, yeah, although many people probably wish we could.
I don't.
We do investigate every single one. And it's very, very difficult for the investigating inspector if you call up a FISDO and say, hey, this guy was flying a drone doing a photo shoot of a event. Let's say it's a concert or something like that. I saw him do it. It's really tough for us to be able to follow up and prove all sorts of different evidentiary items to submit to court, items of proof, things like that. So we need as much information as you can, which is why a lot of times we recommend you contact law enforcement because two reasons. One, they will get there far quicker than any FAA inspector could ever dream of getting there. By the time you call us and tell us that there's an illegal UAS activity going on, do we jot down the notes? Do we check out a government car? Do we get in the parking lot to drive? I mean, it's 20 minutes before I can get out of the parking lot. By then, that thing's down in the case, in the trunk, and gone. Law enforcement can get there much quicker. We ask law enforcement, and we have guidance for them, to get information about the operator, where it happened, when it happened, the type of UAS, if it was registered, if it was not registered, submit a police report, and then we can use that as our primary item of proof in a case against an illegal UAS operation. We don't ask that law enforcement confiscate the UAS. We don't have the authority to do that. So that's what we need from the community. It's going to have to be much more of a community policed event because we just don't have 20,000 FAA inspectors. I think the last time I checked, we had somewhere around 3,600 total for the entire country. And we cover everything from airline operations all the way to UAS and amateur rockets. So we're stretched thin on personnel. But rest assured, when you call in or when you report an illegal UAS activity, potential UAS activity, we investigate it every single time.
Good to know. Very good to know. All right, let's move into some happier, not so intense subjects. So one of the questions I had is in AC-107-2, I think it was Appendix Bravo Charlie. Can't really remember. But one of the questions that I have for you is in there, it talks about, you know, record keeping and log books and maintenance logs. And I understand the importance of maintenance logs. If I don't know how many hours I have on a particular propeller, you know, I could literally lose that propeller from tracking too much. And for those of you listening, don't know what tracking on a propeller is, Google that. But if my propeller tracks too much and I could have a failure, I could lose the whole drone. But I think the argument online is it actually law to keep logbooks and maintenance? And if it is, what type of logbooks and maintenance are going to be acceptable? And where am I going with this, analog versus digital?
Sure. There is no rule under Part 107 which requires you to maintain a logbook. We do not require you to log your flight time. We do not require you to log component service time or anything like that directly. Now, we obviously have rules about pre-flighting your UAS prior to flight and ensuring that it's in a safe condition for flight. So as you pointed out, Paul, one of the things that we like to see in aviation, manned aviation, everything is logged because we have some rules under Part 61 which require a certain amount of flight time, so many hours and so many days and things like that. While we don't have that for Part 107, it would absolutely be considered a best practice to continue that tradition, so to speak. If I were running a UAS business, I would want to be able to tell my potential customers I have got so many thousands of hours of UAS operation to build up my business model. Say you want to hire me because I got more experience doing this than anybody else around. From a safety and a risk management standpoint, when you unpack that UAS out of your case and you get ready to go, how do you know how many hours you may have on that particular propeller or that particular bearing or the servo or the battery life? Does the battery have a useful life? So those types of things, to me, would necessitate having a logbook. But the short answer is no, we don't require you to track flight hours. But boy, I tell you, from a risk management standpoint, Paul, like you mentioned, it's a great idea because if you've got a component that has a effective life of 50 hours, and let's say that you've been flying for 4 months straight, it's been a busy summer and you got a lot of UAS activity going on, and you're flying on your last flight and that propeller comes off, snaps, loses its composure, delaminates, whatever happens, and you lose control of the UAS and it crashes, you're probably going to get a visit from an FAA inspector. And one of the questions that...
From you.
Could be from me. but one of the questions that they would ask or that I would ask would be simply, how many hours did you have on that propeller? You've got a manufacturer maintenance practice manual here that says you're going to replace it every 50 hours. And if your answer is, I don't know, boy, I've been flying a lot all summer long, I have no idea how many hours I have on that propeller. Do you think that's a good safety procedure? Do you think you did an adequate pre-flight on that device? Do you think it was really safe for flight if you have no idea how many hours you have on a particular component when the manufacturer of that component is saying, time out, we need to fix it. Every 50 hours, you got to replace it, whether you think it's broken or not, for safety purposes. So absolutely, keeping a logbook is a fantastic idea. Highly recommend you do it. But no, it's not regulatorily, required.
Good to know. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. All right, last question here. I promise the bloody match will be over soon. Flying on a 333 versus a 107. Now, there are still some companies out there that have their 333s. I've seen the fact they have expiration dates on them. And we could run into an instance where if you've got a big enough UAS business and you've got one team operating under Section 333 because, well, they've got an actual Part 61 pilot out there, they're doing their own thing. But another guy in the business got his 107 certificate. He's out working in the field. So the question is how does the FAA look upon businesses that operate dually under the 333 exemption and 14 CFR 107? And the reason I ask that is because if I understand it correctly, the 333 exemption is actually saying your UAS is exempt from the Part 91 and Part 61 operating rules of the National Airspace System. So can you clarify that for us?
Sure. Another really good question. It has to do, like you mentioned, a lot of confusion out there too. If you hold a 333 exemption right now, and it's still valid, like you pointed out, Paul, there's expiration dates on them. Just as a side note, when they expire, if it's a standard 333 exemption, meaning you didn't have anything fancy in there, it will probably drop dead on that date because, as most people realize, Part 107 was far more permissive than most of the 333 exemptions ever were. I mean, just look at the pilot and command requirements between the two.
The distance requirements, you know,
flying over people. Requirements, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So if you have a 333 exemption and it's valid now, it's still valid. And if you also hold a remote pilot certificate, you could operate under Part 107. That's certainly valid. The way the FAA looks at UAS flights is on a flight-by-flight basis. And that's no different than saying whether you're a hobbyist or whether you're Part 107 or 333. Prior to flight, you have to decide what category you're going to operate under. So you may have a UAS and it's Saturday and you just want to fly it for fun. You don't have to comply with Part 107. My mission today is just I'm doing this for fun. I'm going to a field. I'm just going to drive it around because I enjoy flying my UAS. And that's perfectly fine. You could say, you know what, my 333 exemption gives me permission because let's say I have a COA, a specific COA attached to my 333, and I can get into this area where, boy, the FAA has been dragging their feet on their airspace authorizations is taking forever. So I want to use my COA under my 333. Prior to flight, you say, I'm operating under my 333. And when you do that, you must comply with every condition and limitation in your 333. Part 107 does not apply to that flight. Now, it's the same UAS you just flew for fun and the hobby on the weekend, but now you're flying the same UAS on your 333 exemption, obviously meaning the fact that it was listed on your 333 or it's a registered and all that good stuff. And then finally, if you held a remote pilot certificate as well, you could say, you know what? My 333 exemption has too many conditions and limitations on it where it would prevent me from doing this flight. But under Part 107, I have a remote pilot. I can operate my UAS under Part 107 and fly this mission here. So I'm going to take off and fly under Part 107. Every one of those scenarios, let's say, involves the same legally registered UAS, and every one of them would be okay. The only thing you can't do is combine the two. I'm going to operate this mission under Part 107 because I don't want to have to go find a Part 61 certified pilot to fly it. And I'm going to use my COA from my 333 exemption to get me into this particular restricted airspace. That's where you can't do it. So they have to be individual categories that you're operating under. And it's on a mission by mission or flight by flight basis.
Wow, you couldn't answer that question better, my friend. I think that really helps set the stage for what is expected. Are there any points that you'd like to hit while we've got you on this show? You've got a big audience to talk to. Any particular things you would like to get across right now? Any statements on the current state of affairs?
Well, I think we're at a unique turning point in aviation, really in the history of aviation. Unmanned aircraft have been around for a long, long time. It's, you know, the unmanned portion of flying devices isn't really new. I think you can go back to towards the end of World War II, they had unmanned aircraft flying around.
1955, Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
Somebody knows his UAS history. That's impressive. But what we're seeing is with the advancement of technology, that UAS has really kind of just grown by leaps and bounds in the last 10 years. So what I like to tell people is learn as much as you can about the airspace you're operating in and the rules that you're operating under. Because while you may not think it's a big deal, if you're flying your UAS here and it, let's say it ends up crashing onto a road or hitting a car, I can all but promise you the local news media will think it's a huge deal. Drone crashes into car on highway. You know, it'll be their lead story most likely because it's a hot topic right now. So go back to my very first point that I made. One of the first things I said to you in the podcast was that it's really up to the UAS community to make sure their members are educated, that they're operating correctly, they're doing things safe, they're mitigating as much risk as they can. And if we do that as a community and as a regulating body like the FAA, and we work together on this, the future looks really, really bright. It's quite exciting. And it's just kind of like, I can't imagine what's happening in the next 10 years with UAS. But again, that other side of that coin, if it's a bad deal, if we're crashing them, if we got a lot of bad operators out there and we're not catching them, or we have people that are saying, you know what, just forget the rules, I'm going to do it my way, it could really go the other way. And we could see a lot more regulation. So, yeah, it's a big growing industry. I'm excited for it. I love doing the education piece of it. I do a lot of webinars. Obviously, jumping on this podcast was huge. I really appreciate the time to come on here and talk UAS.
Oh, we appreciate it, too. When you said education, community, self-policing, for a second there, I was like, is that an endorsement for Drone U? Like, excuse me? So, no, I...
for the carpet for that one. I mean, I can't be endorsing anyone as an FAA guy, but...
No, I know. That's why I'm just giving you a hard time. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really couldn't say thank you enough. Thank you for, you know, trying to clarify these positions, these issues. I know you guys are doing a lot to make it right, and I know we really appreciate that. I know the FAA's new app... You know, that whole app, how long do you think that'll take to really be implemented?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question there. I was told that they're shooting for 6 months to have a prototype developed, and then 6 months after that to be released for use. So within the next 12 months. But I can imagine people shaking their heads right now looking at this podcast saying, it's a government, right? 12 months, you got to multiply it by the government factor of 4, so 4 years from now. I don't know. I would like to think we're doing better than that. We are certainly trying, but my hope is that within the next 12 months that app would be live and functional for the UAS community.
Well, you know what I want for Christmas, Kevin, is an app from the FAA. I'm kidding. Kevin, thank you again so much for coming on the show. If you'd like to learn more about Kevin, again, he is part of the FAST team on the FAA website. I actually recommend that you become a member of the FAST team. They send you information about upcoming TFRs, potential anti-GPS testing, for example, here in the Southwest. I get those emails all the time, which really help me plan out when I need to go out and fly. So I recommend you become part of the FAST team, and you may even get some emails from Kevin yourself. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show. We do greatly appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome, sir. And guys, that's going to do it for us today. You heard Kevin. Education is key. Make sure you share this podcast with someone because it could clarify a lot of the issues that are going on in the community as a whole. And thank you always for listening. If you have a question, go to askdroneu.com and upload it right away. Well, that's going to do it for us today. My name is Paul, and this is Ask Drone U.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sound have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.